If you're new here, welcome! This episode is part of a special six-part season where we spent the last 8 months of 2025 with four biographers, following them through the messy, exhilarating reality of writing biography. If you want to start from the beginning, go back to episode one. Trust me, it's worth it. Okay, let's go. This is Four Paths, One Impossible Dream. I'm Jenny Skoog. We've talked about the work. We've talked about the business. But we haven't talked about the ideas, the arguments these four biographers are actually making, what they found that surprised them, what made them angry, what made them rethink everything that they thought they knew. This is episode four, Challenging the Canon. Sarah Benincasa grew up thinking she knew the Lincoln story. I think we all did. He was born poor. He freed the slaves. He saved the Union. He was shot at Ford's Theater. Then Sarah started actually reading.
I looked at what people seemed to find fascinating about him. And at the time I was doing my research, there was a whole to-do about his sexuality, which has been a question for a long time, and it gets very popular every few years. And it was very popular at TikTok when I started thinking about this. And I started thinking, well, why? Why do people care so much what Abraham Lincoln said? Why does that matter to them? I'm not saying this in a morally judgmental way. No, I find it fascinating to think about why they care. And looking at the fact that Abraham Lincoln presided over what is to date, or he was, I should say, directly involved in what is to date the largest mass execution on American soil. Why wasn't I taught about that in school? Why wasn't I taught about the massacre at Mankato?
December 26, 1862. Mankato, Minnesota. 38 Dakota men hanged simultaneously. Lincoln had reviewed the cases and commuted most of the death sentences, but not all. The men who were executed had not been permitted to have legal representation at trial.
I have a friend who has a family member who has a name in memory of those lost to what was a mass execution for men who had not been permitted to have representation on trial.
3 days after Mankato, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation.
And I was taught in school that the Emancipation Proclamation freed all the slaves. No, it didn't. It left, I believe, estimating here. Being on a podcast about biographers, I'm now like, I should have had all my notes in front of me. But it left, I believe, 400,000 to 500,000 people still in bondage. Why? Why didn't the Emancipation Proclamation free all the slaves? I thought that's what he did. I thought that was his whole deal.
It wasn't his whole deal. The proclamation only applied to states in rebellion. If you were enslaved in a border state that stayed loyal to the Union, like Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, Lincoln's proclamation didn't touch you. And then there was Mary Todd.
And what about his wife? I hear she was a spendthrift. What was wrong with her? Why was she so selfish? Well, all these value judgments that I heard, I started looking into her life and into what she suffered. And I was fascinated.
Sarah found a parallel between Abraham and Mary Todd that she couldn't let go of.
Utterly fascinated that these two people, one who lost his mother to milk sickness when he was 9 years old, the other who lost her mother when she was six, these two people who, one growing up in comfort and wealth in Kentucky in a slaveholding family, the other in abject poverty, received two very different stepmothers, and how that changed the course of their lives individually, and how in some ways that may have been what drew them together.
Sarah saw a human story hiding inside the myth, and she wanted to tell it without turning Lincoln into either a saint or a villain.
I thought, I can write a book that looks into the things I find fascinating about the man, that is not simply a fan letter or an homage, but that also does not seek to tear him down and annihilate him in some way, because either one of those things would be such an act of hubris, but that seeks to sort of look at this very complex individual in the context of his life and times.
Neither fan nor annihilation. That's the tightrope that Sarah's walking. And it might be the hardest sentence to live up to in this entire series. Kevin McRuder has a document that most Fisher scholars don't.
I have his death certificate. He died of abdominal adhesions, and that is not cancer, and that's what many of the biographies say.
Abdominal adhesions, meaning scar tissue from multiple surgeries. Fisher had been sick for about a year and a half before he died in 1934. He'd had to quit his job because he couldn't work. The previous biographer, Calvin Sinnett, was a physician. Sinnett had gotten closer to the truth than most. But the myth still persisted, that Fisher's death was some kind of mystery, possibly connected to his work with X-rays, possibly cancer.
When people write about him, they make it seem like a mystery, but it's not.
The cause of death is right there in the document that Kevin has, and yet writers keep treating it like an open question, because the mystery is more interesting than the answer. But that's what biography does. It replaces a good story with the truth, and sometimes the truth is less dramatic. But it matters. Kevin was also uncovering what Fisher was like as a person, not just as a name in literary history. His book proposal opens with a scene from 1932.
It's 1932. He's the first Black guest on WINS radio program in New York in a program called Meet the Author. This was covered in newspapers, and so there's a fair amount of his voice that comes through. And in it, you get a sense he's confident, he's relaxed, he's funny. But the reason he's on is because his second novel, The Conjure Man Dies, had been published, and it's one of the earliest mystery novels by a Black author. And she asked him, well, how did he decide to do that? And he said, well, I heard the royalties are pretty good.
That's Fisher telling a joke on live radio in 1932. Clearly funny, sharp, and comfortable in public. Definitely not a footnote in someone else's story. And Kevin understood something about Fisher's literary world that most scholarship misses. The Harlem Renaissance was not one unified movement. It was an argument.
There was a tension that mirrored the tension that was developing in the 80s around hip-hop in terms of what kind of image should Black people present in their art. Langston Hughes in 1926 writes an essay, The Negro and the Racial Mountain, where he is basically saying, we're going to write what we want to write. If you like it, fine. If you don't, too bad. And then there are people like Jesse Fawcett and W.E. Du Bois at NAACP Opportunity Magazine, who feel that the work should present the best of what Black people can be.
The same fight that would erupt 60 years later over hip-hop, who gets to represent Black life in art and how, was already happening in the 1920s, and Fisher threaded the needle.
His two novels are both based in Harlem, but it's not all middle class, it's not all poor people, it's a mix of everybody. And I think that's what attracted me to him.
That's what Kevin is trying to put on the page. The full Harlem, not some curated version. And then the competition. Since our last episode, Kevin had gotten some news.
I was contacted by a person who said they were working on a group biography of three Harlem physicians. And one of them was Rudolph Fisher. And we had, you know, email correspondence. And I shared some of the things I have, in part with the thought that if they are going to write about him, it's an opportunity to correct the record. So like the death certificate and that, because that's something that just is not accurate.
Kevin shared his research. He sent the death certificate information. He was generous. And then?
They wrote an article in the online version of American Scholar, is where I saw it. And it's about Fisher. The article is only about him. And they sent it to me. I saw it before they sent it, though, because I was looking at something and I saw it the day it was published. When they sent it, I replied, In their response to me, they said they will continue to work on that, but Fisher will be their primary focus in the biography. So I don't know how to feel about that.
Kevin has been thinking about Rudolf Fischer since 1982. He's traced the parents nobody else has traced. He has the death certificate. He has the Winds radio scene. And now someone else, someone he helped, is writing about Fischer too. When I asked Katie Rose what felt different about her book in January 2026 versus a year earlier, she didn't hesitate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it feels like very sadly extremely relevant. A lot of the stuff that the people in my book were working on were trying to basically like build an administrative state to protect people and to, you know, make sure people weren't getting hurt on the job or poisoned by their food or this endless list of things that are necessary that we really take for granted. And it truly has been a little while to just see, I mean, we've all lived through this past year, just see so many things that we sort of took for granted just being demolished piece by piece.
The worker protections, the food safety regulations, the child labor laws, the systems that Jane Addams and Julia Lathrop and Florence Kelly and Alice Hamilton and Grace Abbott spent their careers building. Katie Rose was watching them get dismantled in real time. And then she told me about a scene she'd been writing.
I was working on a section where one of the characters testified before Congress about why there shouldn't be a literacy requirement for immigrants. Like, they shouldn't have to be able to read and write in their own language for various reasons. And, you know, it just feels so relevant, these particular fights they're involved in.
Congressional testimony about immigration policy from more than a century ago. And it reads like it was written last week. Katie Rose had also discovered something surprising about her five subjects.
Only one of them was a mother.
Out of the five women who built the systems that protect American families, only one of them had children of her own. The other four were unmarried and childless, living and working together at Hull House and beyond.
They were defying, like, kind of a lot of the expectations of women of their era and of their social class. One of them is a mother, and I do find that so interesting, and what it must have been like for her to balance her work with her three children.
Katie Rose, who has three kids of her own, could relate. Kate Culkin had a problem with Edith Emerson Forbes. Not a research problem, but an audience problem.
Sometimes people want to ask sort of challenging questions about Edith and her, you know, her racism, her relationship to imperialism. And those I'm happy to answer. I've noticed that the camps around Edith, everybody loves Ellen. They wish she supported suffrage, but some people are like fascinated by her, and some people are like, oh, she was a rich white lady who had really problematic views. And both of those things are true.
Edith was fascinating, and she had problematic views, the kind of opinions that are hard to sit with when you've spent years writing about someone. Kate had braced herself for hostile questions at her events.
I was anticipating a gotcha question, but I never really got one. Like, I never got someone who was like, years ago when I gave a talk, a sort of works in progress talk, someone came and was like, you're just trying to tear down Emerson by, I don't know what, saying his daughters helped him. I'm not quite sure. But I haven't had any of that. I was sort of prepared for that. You just never know in a public situation. Most of the events were free, but I didn't get any of that.
No gotcha questions. But Kate still had to figure out how to talk about Edith, honestly, without excuses, but with the complexity a biographer owes her subject.
I always wanted to answer in a way that felt fair to her and fair to my understanding of her life and the choices that she made that don't excuse her, but also give us a complex portrait of this person.
That's the biographer's job. And it's harder than it sounds. It would be easy to ignore Edith's racism. It would be easy to condemn it. The difficult thing is to hold both truths at the same time. This woman did remarkable things, and this woman held ugly views. Biography doesn't let you pick one. Kate had wrestled with another challenge, too, one that's less dramatic, but just as real for anyone writing nonfiction. She had too much material.
My fear of this book was that it was just like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Because I had so many primary sources and I was so in love with them. I often respond to other people's writing when it's just too detailed, like when it just has so many details and you can just tell the author fell in love with the details and weren't thinking about how to keep the story moving or like how many details did they need to prove this point.
The biographer's trap. Sarah's trap was falling in love with research. Kate's trap was falling in love with details. Both are forms of the same thing. The material is so rich that you lose sight of the reader. So we've got these four biographers who have four different arguments with history. Sarah is dismantling Saint Abraham piece by piece, replacing the cartoon angel with a real man who presided over a mass execution and couldn't free everyone that he wanted to free, and whose wife was not crazy. She was grieving. Kevin has a death certificate and a radio transcript and a competitor. He's trying to put full Harlem on the page, not a curated version, and someone else just showed up to write about the same man. Katie Rose is watching the institutions her subjects built get demolished in real time. Congressional testimony from 100 years ago that reads like yesterday's news. Five women, and only one of them is a mother, defying every expectation of their era. And Kate is holding two truths at the same time. Edith Emerson was remarkable, and Edith Emerson was a racist. Biography doesn't let you pick one. Next time, the emotional toll. Who keeps you going when you're writing at 5:30 in the morning about someone who's been dead for 100 years? What almost made you quit? And what happens when the person you're writing about starts to feel like a friend? Four Paths, One Impossible Dream is a production of BioPodcast and Biographers International Organization. Ellie and Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Carolyn Van Putten is our assistant producer. Cherie Newman is our engineer, and Sonia Williams is our executive producer. I'm Jenny Skoog. Special thanks to Sarah Benincasa, Kate Culkin, Kevin McRuder, and Katie Rose Quant for letting me into their lives and their work. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org.